So a few disclaimers as we start this class. I'll say up front, I think this class is probably going to be a little bit ridiculous. I don't know if it's going to be fun ridiculous yet or just weird ridiculous, but we're going to find out together. So we're all on this ride. We'll see where it goes. Our title, if you haven't already seen in the bulletin, is A Few More Thoughts on Tom Bombadil. So a little bit of context and some disclaimers to set expectations. This class is a little bit thrown together. We had a gap in the schedule, and then I had gotten some entertaining, I'll say, feedback on my sermon illustration last week about Tom Bombadil. I'll read you my favorite one. I won't identify anyone, but this came from a small group after their meeting. Someone wrote, "Good meeting last night. A church split was averted when the pro-Bombadil and anti-Bombadil factions united against their true common enemy, the New York Yankees and all their fans." So I'm glad I could cause people to think and also bring them together again in the end. It was mean, yeah, yeah.
I don't think your mic is on.
I think I'm on.
Yeah, it's on.
It's not coming through to the earpiece, maybe? Okay, we'll get you set up. Okay, so I'm going to share a few more thoughts about Tom. I didn't, as I said, have a ton of time to pull this together this week, so this is not a comprehensive lecture on Tom Bombadil. Of course, that would take a series, as we all know. But just a few more thoughts on Tom Bombadil. It's all we're doing, as I said. I don't know that we're going to take up the whole Sunday school hour. It might be a briefer class, but who knows if some interesting conversations get going. So, second disclaimer, I'm just going to say up front, so no one is surprised. I'm not actually a Lord of the Rings expert, especially compared to some of the people in this room, which is what makes me a little sheepish teaching on it in front of some of you. I'm going through Lord of the Rings again now, but I'm not really good at rereading novels, so it's been years since I've gone all the way completely through. I'm not the guy who's got all of the little facts memorized. In fact, at our small group this past week, Theo White set me straight on a couple of facts about Gandalf that I had wrong. So there you go. So many of you will have more comprehensive knowledge. One thing I enjoyed, and maybe the place where I catch on, is focusing on a few details and digging down in them. I read Lord of the Rings the first time, actually as part of a college class. It wasn't something that I read growing up or that we really had, that we focused on as a family. So I read it in college as part of a class I was taking on Tolkien and Lewis. That's the class I ended up writing that final paper on Tom Bombadil and comparing him to the Green Knight in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which Tolkien had translated and also that he appreciated. So both in that setting and since then, looking at some of the world creation things Tolkien's doing and considering what kind of things he's teaching us through those has been a thing that I've enjoyed. So we're going to look at a few of those things, I think, that we see for Tom Bombadil. I think that Tom Bombadil can teach us about three things I want to look at this morning. He can help us think about the link between creation and recreation, the difference between dominion and domination, and then the last one I'm just calling how to be a person. So those are the three things we're going to think about, you know, minor things, of course, but we'll draw from them. So, and as I talk, I'll give credit along the way, but I'll be drawing a bit from a book I listened to actually this past week as I was thinking about doing this by C.R. Wiley called In the House of Tom Bombadil. I had not read this before. It hadn't shaped my kind of earlier thinking about Tom, but it helped kind of, he brought some of those things together, made it a little easy to put it in a sort of package for this morning. So I'll be relying on that a bit. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning. I'm hoping it's spiritually edifying. Any questions before I dive in? Or should I not even ask yet?
Yeah.
Read
that.
I have not read that book. My oldest daughter has been pestering me for years to read that book because she loves that book and talks whenever Narnia or planets come up, she launches into an explanation of the connections. But I did not know about that, so I'm going to have to read that section. So, okay, all right. All right, let me start us off with the first thing that I think Tom Bombadil helps us think about the link between creation and recreation. And I talked a little bit about this on last Sunday, but I want to kind of get into it a little bit more. And in The Lord of the Rings, this link is made with the role of music, the role that music plays. So in Tolkien's creation story, the world, as I mentioned briefly on Sunday, is sung into existence. And God, who's named in this world Ilúvatar, doesn't do it alone, but he uses the Ainur as well. He brings them in on the process. The Ainur are these sort of like archangels that he has created. They're part of his creation process. And let me summarize. I'll read a little bit and summarize a bit from the creation story that's in the first section of the Silmarillion. It starts like this. There was Eru, the One, who in Arda is called Ilúvatar. And he made first the Ainur, the Holy Ones, that were the offspring of his thought, and they were with him before aught else was made. And he spoke to them, propounding to them themes of music. And they sang before him, and he was glad. But for a long while they sang only each alone, or but a few together, while the rest hearkened. For each comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilúvatar from which he came, and in the understanding of their brethren they grew but slowly. Yet ever as they listened, they came to a deeper understanding and increased in unison and harmony. And it came to pass that Ilúvatar called together all the Ainur and declared to them a mighty theme, unfolding to them things greater and more wonderful than he had yet revealed. And the glory of its beginning and the splendor of its end amazed the Ainur, so that they bowed before Ilúvatar and were silent. Then Ilúvatar said to them, "Of the theme that I have declared to you, I will now that ye make in harmony together a great music. And since I have kindled you with the flame imperishable, you shall show forth your powers in adorning this theme, each with his own thoughts and devices, if he will. But I will sit and hearken and be glad that through you great beauty has been wakened into song." So the Ainur then sing Ilúvatar's theme, but then Melkor, one of the Ainur who's most powerful among them, desired his own glory and begins to sing a different theme in contradiction of Ilúvatar's theme. And the music then gains dissonance and discord, and it seems to falter, but then Ilúvatar rises and he introduces a variation on his theme, which battles against Melkor's theme. After that has played, Ilúvatar rises again and introduces a new second theme altogether. And the theme of Melkor and the new theme of Ilúvatar both continue, and they continue at odds with each other. But the music of Ilúvatar, Tolkien writes, takes the most triumphant notes of Melkor and weaves them into Ilúvatar's own theme, taking over Melkor's purposes for them and making them serve Ilúvatar's purposes. Finally, Ilúvatar rises a third time, and Tolkien writes, "Then he raised both his hands, and in one chord, deeper than the abyss, higher than the firmament, piercing as the light of the eye of Ilúvatar, the music ceased. Then Ilúvatar spoke, and he said, 'Mighty are the Ainur, and mightiest among them is Melkor. But that he may know, and all the Ainur, that I am Ilúvatar, those things that ye have sung, I will show them forth, that ye may see what ye have done. And thou, Melkor, shall see that no theme may be played that has not its uttermost source in me, nor can any alter the music in my despite. For he that attempteth this shall prove but mine instrument in the devising of things more wonderful, which he himself hath not imagined.'" And Ilúvatar then gives them a vision. He directs them to the void. And we read, "But when they were come into the void, Ilúvatar said to them, 'Behold your music.' And he showed them a vision, giving to them sight where before was only hearing. And they saw a new world made visible before them, and it was globed amid the void, and it was sustained therein, but was not of it. And as they looked and wondered, this world began to unfold its history, and it seemed to them that it lived and grew. And when the Ainur had gazed for a while and were silent, Ilúvatar said again, "Behold your music. This is your minstrelsy. And each of you shall find contained herein, amid the design that I set before you, all those things which it may seem that he himself devised or added. And thou, Melkort, shall discover all the secret thoughts of thy mind, and will perceive that they are but a part of the whole and a tributary to its glory." Now, this is just a vision in the story, but what follows is that it becomes clear that the music of Ilúvatar and the Ainur will be manifest in the creation of the world and also of its creatures, and then of the events of history. And so both creation and providence are contained in the music. And the triumph of the music of Ilúvatar over the music of Melkor is going to play out in history then as the triumph of good over evil in the world. Now, I bring all of this up again because, as we mentioned on Sunday, music is so central to the character of Tom Bombadil in Lord of the Rings. We went over that story where the hobbits are in the old forest. They come under the spell of Old Man Willow. One of them, Frodo, is thrown into the river and held down by Old Man Willow's roots. The other two are trapped as the tree snaps shut in two of the places they were resting. So they find themselves in this situation. Frodo begins to call for help, and the first thing they hear from Tom, actually, as he begins to come to rescue them, is a song. They hear a song off from a distance, then he arrives and they talk with him. I'll just read that conversation. "My friends are caught in the willow tree," cried Frodo breathlessly. "Master Merry's been squeezed in a crack," cried Sam. "What?" shouted Tom Bombadil, leaping in the air. "Old Man Willow? Not worse than that, eh? That can soon be mended. I know the tune for him. Old Gray Willow Man, I'll freeze his marrow cold if he don't behave himself. I'll sing his roots off. I'll sing a wind up and blow leaf and branch away, Old Man Willow." Setting down his lilies carefully in the grass, he ran to the tree. There he saw Merry's feet still sticking out. The rest had already been drawn further inside. Tom put his mouth to the crack and began to sing into it with a low voice. They could not catch the words, but evidently Merry was aroused. His legs began to kick. Tom sprang away and, breaking off a hanging branch, smote the side of the willow with it. "You let them out again, Old Man Willow," he said. "What be you a-thinking of? You should not be waking. Eat earth. Dig deep. Drink water. Go to sleep. Bombadil is talking." He then seized Merry's feet and drew him out of the suddenly widening crack. There was a terrible creak, and the other crack split open, and out of it Pippin sprang, as if he had been kicked. Then, with a loud snap, both cracks closed fast again. A shudder ran through the tree from root to tip, and complete silence fell. The hobbits thank him, and then he brings them to his house. So it's through song we see that Tom calls the willow tree to go back to acting the way it was intended to. The willow tree wasn't made with the intention of it attacking others. It was made to be different. And Tom sings it back to its creational intent. As it was sung into being, so it's also sung back into being what it should be. And so creation and correction in this case are really in many ways the same act. We see this pattern again a couple chapters later when Tom rescues the hobbits from the Barrow-wight. So the hobbits spend some time with Tom, then they're sent on their way. He warns them about essentially the graves of the old kings that are haunted. They don't heed that warning as much as they should, and soon they find themselves captured by something like a ghost. They call for Tom again. They sing a song he taught them to call for him. And here again, as he's coming, they hear him singing. And what he sings, and I apologize, I'm not going to sing it for you. What he sings as he comes is, "Old Tom Bombadil is a merry fellow. Bright blue his jacket is, and his boots are yellow. None has ever caught him yet, for Tom he is the master. His songs are stronger songs, and his feet are faster." His songs are what make him stronger. And then he sings the Barrow-wight away. The song he sings is, "Get out, you old white, vanish in the sunlight, shrivel like the cold mist, like the winds go wailing, out into the barren lands, far beyond the mountains, come never here again, leave your barrow empty, lost and forgotten be, darker than the darkness, where gates stand forever shut, till the world is mended." At these words, there was a cry, and part of the inner end of the chamber fell in with a crash. Then there was a long, trailing shriek fading away into an unguessable distance. And after that, silence. Ghosts don't belong haunting the world, and Tom sings this one out of the world. He also alludes to a future when the world will be mended, such song will drive all evil out from the brokenness of this world forever. And so again, you have this picture of creation and correction, of creation and recreation, all intimately linked. They can't be separated in Tolkien's world. Tom makes that clear. The world is sung into existence, and the world will be sung back to the way that it should be. So why am I focusing on that theme? Well, it's helpful for us, I think, and it's a helpful picture, at least for me, because we have a tendency to separate creation and redemption at times. We might see, as a common example we talk about, the physical world is bad and the spiritual world is good, so creation is sort of downgraded, redemption is seen as a separate and better thing. Or maybe we see nature and creation as something that's just sort of neutral, and God's redeeming work is a higher plane above it. And so you end up with sort of a two-storied view of the world. You've got nature, you've got what's been created, and then you have the higher spiritual realm of redemption, of grace that goes above it. But when we do that, we tend in one way or another to value grace over nature. And with that, I think, misunderstand the relationship between them. But in the Reformed tradition, and we see this as a theme that's especially focused on in the work of Herman Bavinck, there's a focus on the concept that grace restores nature, that that's the proper way to view the relationship, that nature, creation as God made it, is good, and grace is not something that's set in contrast to nature, any more than the physical and spiritual should be set in contrast to each other, but rather grace is set against sin, and grace is at work to restore and glorify nature to what it was meant to be. So grace is not some higher plane above nature, but rather a work to restore it. Grace restores nature. Which also means that God as Redeemer and God as Creator are two things that are intimately tied together. They can't really be separated. The same God, again in a sense, who sang the world into existence, will sing it back to the way it was always intended to be. Of course, there's a distinction between God's works of creation and his work of redemption, but that distinction isn't a separation, because the two are deeply connected to each other. God's redeeming work is restoring creation to its true nature, just as Tom's song was restoring, even if briefly, creation back to how it was supposed to be. That pattern, biblically speaking, is true of the resurrection, of course, but it's also true now for us in our salvation, in our redemption. When we are born again, Christ is renewing our nature in some ways back to its creational intent. And when we're sanctified, Christ is again renewing our nature back to what it was created to be. In that sense, we are the ones who are like old man Willow, and Jesus is the one at work sanctifying us. He's speaking through his words, or singing, if you like, his original creational intent back into us. And so creation and recreation, nature and grace, are things that are all tied up together. The same God does both, and that should give us a higher view, in a sense, both of creation and of grace. And so Tom, in his songs, displays for us this connection between creation and recreation. He shows us how grace is working to restore nature. That's the first thought that we see in Tom and Lord of the Rings I wanted to reflect on. I'll go on to the other, but any thoughts or questions or comments or strong objections at this point? No? You're all coming along with me so far? Okay, we'll see how the next one goes. All right. So the second thing that Tom shows us is the difference between dominion and domination. And that distinction is actually a really important theme in Lord of the Rings. I'm going to say a few detailed things about it, but it's also a reason, I think, why we have Tom more towards the front of the story. Tolkien, in a letter, commented that he recognized for the storyline, Tom wasn't really necessary, but he also said that Tom, he doesn't get very specific, but he says Tom was a comment that he felt was necessary, something he wanted to say about the world that was important. And I think there's a few ways that that plays out as we're talking about, but one is that we're talking, and Tom's not the only example of this, but we're talking in Lord of the Rings, one of the big themes is power, is what is power, how should it be used? And as you go along, you could even come away with the impression that power maybe just in and of itself is bad. Tom has said at the beginning to show us what good power, rightly used, looks like. He is the master. There's no question of his power. And later on at the Council of Elrond, they'll talk about how if the forces of evil take over the world, Tom will likely be the last to fall, which is a striking statement. He'll hold out the longest. So Tom is very powerful. We see his power at work. But right at the beginning, lest we misunderstand and think that the whole issue is that power and authority is inherently bad, Tolkien gives us this picture of power rightly used. And it's a picture of dominion over creation rather than domination. And this, of course, is a theme we think about as Christians. We know that we were made to exercise dominion. We were called to exercise dominion as humanity. But after the fall, we're tempted more often towards domination instead. And Tom helps us tease out the distinctions of that a little bit. And again, some of the distinctions come in a portion I quoted from partially on Sunday, but it's where Goldberry, Tom's wife, is asked who Tom is. "Fair lady," said Frodo again after a while, "tell me, if my asking does not seem foolish, who is Tom Bombadil?" "He is," said Goldberry, staying her swift movements and smiling. Frodo looked at her questioningly. "He is as you have seen him," she said in answer to his look. "He is the master of wood, water, and hill." "Then all this strange land belongs to him," Frodo says. "No, indeed," she answered, and her smile faded. "That would indeed be a burden." She added in a low voice as if to herself, "The trees and the grasses and all things growing or living in the land belong each to themselves. Tom Bombadil is the master. No one has ever caught old Tom walking in the forest, wading in the water, leaping on the hilltops under light and shadow. He has no fear. Tom Bombadil is master." And Sarah Wiley, who I mentioned earlier, unpacks this a little bit more. If I can find the right section here. And he unpacks it in terms of this theme of dominion versus domination. He says, "Dominion has gotten a lot of bad press. But here's the pregnant passage from the book of Genesis. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" The Hebrew word that's translated dominion, this is again Wiley, means something like skilled mastery. And that's definitely what we see when we look at Tom. But skilled mastery can be a problem, as we see with the Ring of Power. When we see the ring in action, we see something very different than Tom Bombadil. When it comes to the ring, we see skill is used in a domineering way. Going forward, I'd like to reflect on the way that Tom exercises dominion, but I need someone to contrast him with. He needs a foil, or better, we can consider Tom to be a foil to our normal, which is to say, abnormal way of thinking about dominion. Think of it like a mirror. A foil flips things, providing an image in reverse, just like the mirror does. So who can we contrast Tom with in The Lord of the Rings? How about Sauron, the Dark Lord himself? Throughout The Lord of the Rings, he looms in the background like a dark, malignant shade. But the problem with Sauron is this. When you look at him, we just see a lidless eye looking back. He's too remote to be useful in this regard, because we don't really know enough about him. Rather than Sauron, my candidate for Bombadil's foil is Saruman. When it comes to him, we have material to work with. And tellingly, his name means man of skill. Wiley goes on to point out that when we meet Saruman, he's using his mastery to imprison Gandalf, but when we meet Tom, he's using his mastery to free the hobbits. Saruman is then criticized by Gandalf for being he who breaks a thing to find out what it is, and so has left the path of wisdom, while Tom is singing things back to the wholeness of what they were meant to be in themselves. Saruman, Treebeard will later note, liked to gather information and insight from others, but he did not share his own knowledge and insight with others. But Tom, we see, with what he has, with the knowledge and the power he has, is generous, and he shares what he knows openly with the hobbits for their good. Saruman, Treebeard later says, is plotting to become a power. He has a mind of metal and wheels, and he does not care for growing things except as far as they serve him for the moment. But Tom, we see, uses his mastery both to oversee and also to cultivate the land that he has dominion over. First, we see him overseeing that land. He oversees the old forest for its own good, and he uses his mastery to bless it, not to exploit it. But with that, he also doesn't leave everything wild. He cultivates not just his own home, but we're told the area around his home. When the hobbits arrive, here we go, when the hobbits arrive, we read, the grass under their feet was smooth and short, as if it had been mown or shaven. The eaves of the forest behind were clipped and trim as a hedge. The path was now plain before them, and on a further slope they saw the twinkling lights of a house. While he adds, as the hobbits approach Tom's house, the first thing they notice is a contrast. They step out of a wild, unruly place into a carefully manicured space. The grass is closely trimmed, and even the forest has been cut back like a hedge. Wiley's comment is, Tom's no hippie. His home is well-ordered and tame. It's domesticated. And so Tom here gives us a picture of dominion that's not domination. It's got two aspects of it. One is that it is an overseeing and at times allowing things simply to be what they are in themselves, but other times he's at work cultivating things. He's shaping them. He's making himself a home. And in the vision of dominion that we're given with that, we do make a home for ourselves, but as we employ creation, we use it along the lines that it was made for. We cultivate it by working with its nature rather than breaking its nature, just as Tom did with his home, not breaking the nature around him as we will later see Saruman do. And then with that, we're also called to exercise mastery over creation, but we're called in many cases to do that for its own good. We're to rule over things in the interest of those things for the glory of their maker and ours. And so our interest in creation isn't supposed to stop when certain things no longer serve our purposes, as again was the case with Saruman. In any case, as Goldberry says, Tom is the master over things without owning them. He allows, he desires each thing to belong to itself, and that doesn't contradict his exercising loving dominion over it. And so the concept of human dominion extends beyond the concept of ownership. Again, we have that contrast with Tom's house, which is his, and then the forest beyond it. We're called to exercise dominion over the world as a whole, but that looks a certain way, and it often looks, as we see with Tom, like a form of service. So we could say more about that, but I'm going to stop that point there with the idea that Tom Bombadil gives us a picture of dominion without domination. So that's a second thought here on Tom. Any questions or comments on that one or objections? Yeah. I didn't hear the last thing you said, sorry. Mm. It's interesting. I hadn't thought about it as much with Radagast. And Radagast is one of the wizards, Radagast the Brown, who also Gandalf tells us about. It's interesting because it fits the pattern, and this is where, as Tolkien himself notes in the introduction, he doesn't like allegory. He doesn't like having just one thing to correspond to each. He likes, as he puts it, telling history, but the history he tells has typological pictures. It's, you know, we can go through the story, and in one part of the story, one character looks a lot like he's a type of Christ. In another part of the story, it's another character, and it's not that one. Things kind of shift around. And in a similar way, I think there's multiple pictures of how we relate to nature. And so I think there's differences and similarities there. So like you said, Radagast, we don't see as much of the cultivation. He's interacting with nature, but we don't see the same level maybe of exercising dominion over it. So that's two pictures. And I think, again, I mean, they're maybe meant to be stacked up and thought through together. A third that Wiley brings out, which I had thought, and it's a common thing to think about, you know, for thinking of relationship to nature, then how do we compare Tom to the Ents? And there's a number of things you could think about there, but one of the things Wiley points out is that the Ents have had trouble bringing the sort of overseeing the wildness of creation and the cultivation of creation together. So one of the things that Treebeard talks about is that the Ents are there, but they've lost all of the Ent wives. And you get as he explains the problem, essentially the Ents, the male Ents, liked to walk through the forest in its sort of more wild state. The Entwives were cultivating gardens and more ordered places. The Ents sort of stopped. Less and less were going to those gardens. And so you have this separation, and now the Ents don't know what happened to the Entwives. They're separated. They're trying to find them. And so you have this split of those two things where they haven't been harmonized. It's interesting with Tom, you have... And with Goldberry, you have both this wild and domestic, this rule and cultivation that are blended together, both in the land and how they each live and also in the relationship. And so you have kind of those three pictures among, I would imagine, others, as you think of Radagast, as you think of Tom, and as you think of the Ents. So I didn't really answer your question so much as talk more about Ents than Radagast, but I like that. I'd like to think more about that. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
So just a comment on your distinction between dominion and domination. I think as I'm listening to you, it occurs to me that that's the key for why I always long to see more of Tom Bombadil's story. In other words, always a gas effect. He doesn't really care. I want him to come back, and I want more of him. And I think it's because exactly what you're saying is he's the one who knows how to do things right. Knows the way things ought to be, and can restore them to the way things ought to be. He's a similar character in my mind to Dickens's character in the Christmas Carol, The Ghost of Christmas Present. He's a similar character. This is the way Christmas ought to be. He's a similar character to Greyheart in Legends of Pilgrim Progress. Greyheart knows how to navigate, how things ought to be, and how to get through pilgrimage. And if I can be so bold, he's a similar character to Gus and Lonesome Dove. Gus knows how things ought to be in the Western. There's always a hero in the Western who knows how to restore things the way they ought to be.
Yeah, no, I thank you for that. I really, really appreciate that, agree with that. And it's interesting, again, I think that it's set, that kind of a character is set before them at the beginning of their quest, that they're given this positive picture. And that one thing I hadn't noticed initially, and again until Wiley's book, was that there's that explicit mention of all things being set right when he sends the barrow wide away. He talks about how the gates will stand forever shut, and then he has this reference of till the world is mended. As I said, I'm not the one who has all of the facts lined up in his mind from Lord of the Rings, but I'm going to be listening for it as I go through this time now. How many references there are really to the whole world being mended and set right, you know, in Lord of the Rings. You have, even as Tolkien wrote things beyond Lord of the Rings, things kind of go downhill. The elves leave, men have issues. The world's not, disaster is averted with the ring, but the world's not exactly mended. And Tom seems to know it's going to be. He's got this reference to that happening, and in many ways, his life points forward to what that would look like, to what that setting things right would be. So, yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have a great answer for it. I'm going to give a little bit of an answer. The answer seems to lie, you know, the two comments that I'm remembering that are made in the Council of Elrond. One is that it just doesn't interest him, and I'll speak a little bit about that. The other is that they talk about his power being in that land itself. There's a way in which Tom is tied to that place, and there's something about that place where he does have dominion. He's exercising dominion there. He's powerful there. It's a little unclear from at least the comment in my mind that's made in the Council of Elrond whether he would have the same kind of power if he went somewhere else. And so there's a localness to him bound to that place. I don't know the sort of ins and outs of that, and it's a bit speculative from what's said, but that seems to be a second part of it, too. Yeah?
In answer to that, I think maybe in part is Tolkien said Tom Bombadil's not an important character. That's a quote from him. And I think he would have to shape the story to make him far more important if he started solving things. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where, again, I think it's helpful that, as he says, Tom's not important to the, I should probably just read it, because I think this is the quote you're alluding to. In a letter that he wrote in 1955, he said, "Tom Bombadil is not an important person to the narrative. I suppose he has some importance as a comment. I mean, I do not really write like that. He is just an invention who first appeared in the Oxford Magazine in about 1933, and he represents something I feel important, though I would not be prepared to analyze the feeling precisely. I would not, however, have left him in if he did not have some kind of function." And so there's ways in which I think his function is less about, it's more about what Tolkien is saying about the world and less about the story arc that his role is. And so, yeah, I don't think he intended him to be a significant part in that way, too. Is there anything? Yeah.
You know, where you have the Shire is certainly like an idyllic place. It's certainly cultivated. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, bringing up Saruman, when he moves in and he exploits it, all the natural resources, and even it says, you know, at the beginning they begin chopping down trees to build houses, ugly houses, and then they just start, you know, chopping down the trees for no good reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, yeah. No, that's great. And for those, yeah, if you're not, I've been sort of assuming a level of knowledge with all this. If you've no familiarity with The Lord of the Rings, I'm sorry. This is probably the weirdest Sunday school you've ever been to. But for those who are only really familiar with the movie, The Scouring of the Shire, I'm told, I gave up on the movies after the second one. I couldn't watch the third, sorry. But I know people love them, and that's great for you. But I'd heard that the third one skipped the Scouring of the Shire. And part of what is great about that part, they come back, Saruman's there. He's taken over the Shire. There's this whole conflict there. Is that it's one of the things at least it is doing is you have all these grand themes about power and dominion and all these big things in this big, you know, epic story. And then at the end, Tolkien, almost to sort of help us take the first step towards applying them, has them all play out again, but in this much smaller scale of the Shire. There's these questions of what's the right way of ordering things, what's the wrong way? What does dominating people look like? What is sort of the a way where people have freedom and are able to flourish look like? How do we respond to our enemies? All of those questions, which play out in big ways in the epic story, are then put into practice in this somewhat smaller scale in the Scouring of the Shire. And it's, I think, meant to push us to then think about how we apply that. And we see the same theme then of that domination of nature versus dominion over nature playing out and how Saruman tries to reorder the Shire. So yeah, that's a good connection. I wasn't thinking of that. All right, let me do one more thought. So third and finally for today, I think Tom Bombadil, as I've said, helps us learn how to be a person. I'm just going with that as a general statement. And we've some comments have alluded to this a little bit. And the way he does, at least the way I would frame it, is I think that he exemplifies some of the things that the book of Ecclesiastes often calls us to. Now, that might sound odd because people tend to think of Ecclesiastes as being a gloomy book, and Tom Bombadil is, you know, not. I would dispute, I think there's gloomy parts of Ecclesiastes, but as a whole, I don't think that's the kind of book that it is. And I'm thinking particularly of some of the concluding statements that come from Ecclesiastes, which are not presenting I can't do a whole theology of Ecclesiastes here. One day I'll do a series on it. But it's not presenting us here, as it's sometimes been read, as a sort of cynical, nothing matters conclusion at each stage, but as these are the good things you're given to enjoy, you should enjoy them. This is what God is calling you to. And so you cycle through these concluding statements in Ecclesiastes. You have first in Ecclesiastes 2, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he's given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vapor and a striving after wind. And then Ecclesiastes 5. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not so much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy of his heart. And then Ecclesiastes 9, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God already approved what you do. Let your garments always be white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vaporous life and that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Finally, from 12, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, for God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. As we see these calls to live rightly and to enjoy the lot that God has called us to, I think, again, we see a picture of that in Tom Bombadil. Again, you really only get this full picture if you kind of go back and read those chapters, especially the chapter in the house of Tom Bombadil. But what you see is Tom going about the work that he's been given and delighting in it. You see him coming home and delighting in his home life, delighting in his wife, rejoicing in the good gifts that he has there. Again, a sort of summary doesn't really do it justice, but this beautiful picture, which at least for me, you read it and it resonates with some sort of in a fantasy context, some sort of a glimpse of what life is supposed to be like, of what God calls us to, of the kind of homes he calls us to seek to have. So C.R. Wiley, again, I mentioned this book was recent for me, but I was familiar with an article he wrote about 10 years ago, which I really enjoyed at the time. I went back, looked at it, still enjoy it. The title of the article is The Bombadil Option, and this came out about the same time that the Benedict Option was really popular. I'm going to read some sections from it. So Wiley writes, Rod Dreher is well known in these parts for his interest in the Benedict Option. I share the interest, but there are times I despair for it. It's a group effort, after all. What do you do when you're groupless, though when you're alone, when you're alone as Elijah in a cave? What then? When I'm feeling melancholy and all alone, that's when I pop open a bottle of my best craft beer and exercise what I call the Bombadil Option. Everyone forgets about merry old Tom Bombadil. Peter Jackson did. He could find time for video game eye candy, but Jolly Tom was expendable. Early on in The Lord of the Rings, even Gandalf writes him off. It's easy to do. He's a sidelight, a detour. He's off the main path. What is he in the story for anyway? Local color? Comic relief? Nope. Wiley writes, I think Tom's the point. From there, Wiley points out that some of us struggle to live our lives, as he puts it, without a quest, or maybe when we've completed a quest and that project is over. We struggle, as he puts it, to live in one place, rooted down, rather than moving from thing to thing frantically. And some of us, Wiley points out, when we're either without a quest or a place to go, or we're done with a quest and we return home, have a tendency to lapse into nostalgia. And he pulls up as an example of this Mary and Pippin at the end of the book, who are seen and known for riding around in their old armor with a sense of nostalgia, reliving their glory days of battle while living quietly in the Shire. And it's not a sad picture, the way it's described, but Wiley notes that as we read it, we may be left wondering if that's really the best we can hope for when the battles of this world are done, a sense of nostalgia for the old days. Others, he points out, in Lord of the Rings may struggle instead with restlessness. And actually, there's a sense in which Gandalf seems to exemplify this. And when he did experience that, when he noted that tendency in himself, when he noted he needed to address it, it was Tom Bombadil that he went to for help. And so we read towards the end of the story, Gandalf is talking to the hobbits. The quest is done. The epic part of the story is concluded. They're walking, and he says to them, but if you would know, I am turning aside soon. Gandalf says, I am going to have a long talk with Bombadil, such a talk as I have not had in all my time. He is a moss gatherer, and I have been a stone doomed to rolling. But my rolling days are ending, and now we shall have much to say to one another. So we get this picture that we can struggle when it's whether a brief moment, a season of life, or a larger part of our lives, to stop rolling and be present somewhere. We can struggle with restlessness. But third, others who are called to one particular place to not move around struggle with bitterness over that. And Wiley points here to the creatures of the old forest. He writes, many of the residents there have grown mean and spiteful, full of envy for things that get around on two legs. Old Man Willow, the Barrow-wights, even those nightly noises the hobbits are told to ignore while they're in Tom's house. But Wiley also notes that this tendency is not limited to trees. He writes, here in New England, where he was ministering at the time, here in New England we have people with roots that go way down. We still have a few old swamp Yankees here and there, living in dilapidated homes, some tracing their ancestry back four or five generations. Some of my parishioners live in homes that predate the Revolution by 50 years. Most of these folks are as colorful and quirky as old Tom, but few are jolly. Sadly, most resemble Old Man Willow. I think Tolkien is saying something about roots here. Sometimes rooted people can be very unpleasant, downright nasty. There's more than one way to live from the roots. For some, roots run deep, but not deep enough. These folks resent everything that moves, the people who have moved away for one. They're bitter for being left behind, and they blame the leavers for taking what has been lost with them. And newcomers only make things worse, bringing their fancy ways, ignorant and presumptuous, driving up property values and raising taxes, tooling around in their fancy foreign cars, taking their fat kids to a soccer practice in the new park that people used to hunt in. If roots could kill, these would. I seem to recall Old Man Willow using a root to hold Frodo under the Withy Windle. Without a place to go or a quest, in other words, we run the risk of living either nostalgically, restlessly, or bitterly. And many of us know this about ourselves, which is why we can't stop moving. We can't stop and actually rest. We can't follow Solomon's advice and stop striving after the wind and just enjoy the good gifts that God has given us. And so instead of endless striving or nostalgia, restlessness, or bitterness, what we see instead is that we're called to follow Tom's example, which is really a picture, I think, in many ways of what Ecclesiastes calls us to do. We should rejoice in the blessings of home, but as Wiley asks, once there, we may have a tendency to wistfully stare out the window and long for significance. He asks, should we do that, or should I, he says, instead gather water lilies for my goldberry and enjoy her charms, eating the food she has prepared for me and sitting by the fire and laughing as I recall the queer antics of badgers? I think so, because that's the world I'm made for, the world I go to save when the lust for derring do sweeps me along. Tom is perfectly delighted in his home with the work he has to do there, the table filled with good food, and his lovely wife Goldberry sitting with him. He's content with where God has put him. Now, Tom, the Council of Elrond notes, and as we mentioned earlier, has no interest in the War of the Ring. But as Wiley points out, Tom's not uncaring. It's just that he cares for what is near and dear. And all the power in the world could not tempt him to leave it. Quests? He takes Frodo's precious ring and performs a magic trick with a laugh and hands it back to him. Frodo, for spite, tries to play his own trick and puts it on, but Tom isn't fooled and looks right at him. Tom's heart simply isn't captured by such things. Nor, Wiley writes, is Tom indifferent. He comes when he's called. That's how the hobbits meet him. But Tom's in no hurry to get anywhere besides home, because what he'd find when he arrived, he's already got at home. Tom is content with creation and with the little part of creation he's been called to delight in it, to enjoy it, to exercise dominion over it. His joy is rooted in God's work and blessing of creation. Wiley writes, Tom's joy comes from knowing the oldest songs, the songs that made the world, those little ditties that seem like nonsense to people without sense. Bombadil isn't curmudgeonly, because he's like Peter Pan, the boy who won't grow up. He's young because he's oldest. His songs are the same ones the morning stars sang at the beginning. He knows them because he heard them on the first day. And nothing can master him, because any tune conjured up by an old willow or even the Dark Lord is just a perversion of a tune he knows by heart. He can sing their song aright. Tom's roots are so deep they can make him light on his feet, no catching him. His songs are stronger songs, and his feet are faster. Finally, Wiley writes, confession time. Most of the time, I'm either on a quest or I'm Old Man Willow, cursing the passing of things once loved. But there are days when I hear an older tune, and I feel like dancing. Those days, I'm Jolly Tom, and I put on my bright blue jacket and my yellow boots, and I go out and gather water lilies for my lady, because I truly have no place to go, and I have nothing better to do. I think we have with that a picture of what Ecclesiastes calls us to, a picture of life at the resurrection, and a picture of what it is to enjoy the gifts that God has given us. So that's my third thought on how Tom Bombadil helps us know how to be a person. Any thoughts, questions, comments, objections, rebuttals? Yeah.
I've thought of how we're aware of things thinking about a diamond. With our physical eyes, we can appreciate a cut diamond, but what kind of hidden gems that will never be found, and the structure of the crystalline patterning that is there that God created and appreciates that we have no awareness of. I mean, even something so mundane as social media, which, you know, can easily be illustrated as evil and the pitfalls of it, but, you know, the wonder of the mass of humanity that is out there, and the quirkiness and the creativity, and you can scroll for hours and be entertained, and you think, this is what the angels are looking down on as it relates to redemption. Not you know, magic tricks and sleight of hand and amazing stupid human tricks, but really the way God is working out redemption. The angels are looking at this and it's
yeah, that you've got the yeah, the beauty of the song of creation that goes, we can zoom in more and more and more on it, and there's more to find, whether we're thinking of biology or physics or chemistry. And then we can zoom out and see these great things. And you could also look broadly across humanity and see what different individuals, different cultures are producing. There's more of it than we can take in, but it's there. Yeah, yeah.
More than a lot of the other characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I was just thinking about the, you know, why Tom Bombadil didn't get more involved in the Lord of the Ring, and I was thinking, like a big theme in the book is duty, and one of my favorite parts is when, Eowyn wants to go and says, "Can I be free to do what I want with my own life?" And when Aragorn says, "If you can do that and live with honor, right?" So it would have been wrong for, say, like Gandalf or Aragorn did not get involved, but really wasn't Tom Bombadil's duty. And then, you know, Tolkien hated, you know, allegory, but he liked what he called the applicability. And there is applicability to that, because you could think about it, like, there are powers, a legion of angels could show up anytime someone tried to martyr a Christian, right? And that doesn't happen. Like, there are powers that aren't involved in things, you know, outside of their duty.
Yeah, no, that's thank you. That's really helpful, and you have this sense, I think, in Lord of the Rings, where in Tolkien's world, where there's certain ages, where certain beings have different responsibilities. Even with Gandalf's planning on stepping back, he says, "I'm stepping back now," and as the next round of issues with humanity come up, he's not going to be a player in that. So you have an aspect of time with that too, which yeah, that's helpful. Had one other hand? Uh-oh. Yeah, I listed it. I knew who was here. Go for it. Yeah. Okay. I look forward to seeing you before the SJC. It'll be good. We'll hash this out. It would be great if we could have in our minutes of Presbytery like a case about Tom Bombadil. That would be my mark on the PCA. Yeah.
To me, Gandalf is sort of the closest for me, and I know that this is not an allegory like C.S. Lewis was, but Gandalf always for me was the closest thing to sort of a Christ figure in the book, because he does sort of come from another world, he's not man, or another. And this is was Pippin's observation about Gandalf. He thought first only the lines of care and sorrow, but underneath he perceived a great joy, a fountain of mirth, and to set the kingdom laughing for it to break forth, which I think is close to that thing of Monica.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm probably not going to bring charges against you.
Okay, I appreciate that. So, see, we do reform Catholicity in this church. It's a thing where we all get along. No, I appreciate that. And part of what I think is, part of what is, I think, one of the delights, and I don't know how he did it. His mind's kind of amazing, but part of one of the lights with something like Lord of the Rings is that you have these multiple pictures of Christ throughout the book. So, yes, obviously you have that with Gandalf, and there's so many ways that you have it with him. You know, another obvious one in certain places, Aragorn, or you think of Frodo, the one who's carrying this burden to destroy it and takes it on to himself. You think of, as I've argued, Tom Bombadil has that, I think, in other ways, but that reality that you need a whole lot of, you can have a whole lot of different pictures that are pointing to different aspects of who the Lord is. You're still not getting a full picture, but with each perspective, you're gaining something. And I think that's certainly true with those, and appreciate that in addition to it. So, all right, we did fill the time. We're out of time. Let me pray for us as we finish. Lord, we give you thanks that you give us your word and you give us your truth, and then you give your people creative powers to create art and story and music that further unfolds and applies and helps us to see more clearly the truth that you've revealed to us, Lord. It takes so many different forms in our day-to-day lives, so many things you've given us to delight in. We thank you for the ways that your truth comes out in this particular work of fiction that we've been discussing this morning. So many other examples as well, Lord, where we can catch a glimpse of or have some aspect of your truth resonate more deeply with our heart as it's put a certain way. Lord, as we think of these things, we pray for your help. We pray that you would help us to more richly see the work of redemption that you're doing in light of creation, that you would help us to think truly and deeply about what it means to take on the responsibility you've given us, to exercise dominion, but not in a way that yields to domination or that serves ourselves. And Lord, as we think about what it is to just do the work you've called us to do, and then enjoy, in glimpses in this life, that Sabbath rest you call us to delight in the good things you've given us, to enjoy the very things that we do the work you've called us to do for, Lord, the gifts that you call us to rejoice in, and the gifts we look forward to for eternity. Lord, help us to, as we think on things like this, to love you more deeply and to see you in a way that perceives you more richly. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks.